decided backhandedly to screw the Russians and to preclude them from having to divvy up Japan after the war. The U.S. wanted Japan to itself. They did not want to have to divide it with Russia. So Truman decided to attack Hiroshima with the first atomic bomb on August 6th, 2 days before Russia was supposed to meet them in Japan, you see.
How is this known?
This is out there. This is all known. Just Google. Seriously, this is all common knowledge now. This is not secret history. This is out there. It's just that the average person doesn't know this stuff that they really should know. So we preempted Russia from helping to defeat Japan by setting off Hiroshima 2 days before our agreed date. So we screwed the Russians, basically.
Knowing that the Japanese were principally afraid of a Russian invasion, they weren't, and they were inured to the bombing, what they feared was the Russian invasion. And so once the Russians were in Manchuria, the Japanese were frantically trying to surrender, and the Americans knew because they'd cracked the codes. And they were thinking, we got to drop the bomb, we got to drop the bomb, we got to drop the bomb.
Yeah, that's right. Now, it turns out, interestingly enough, Russia had never declared war on Japan during World War II. However, on August 8th, remember that was the date that Russia was going to come into Japan, on August 8th, the USSR finally declared war on Japan, and the Japanese policymakers were freaked out. It just, you know, it was a shockwave because they feared Russia more than the U.S. at that point. And so that led to their decision to finally capitulate. But it took them 5 days after Nagasaki. You know, when I first learned about the atomic bombings when I was, you know, in high school, I just assumed that after Nagasaki, that's it. The war would be end. You know, Japan would declare, you know, that they lost. But it took 5 days. And the reason it took 5 days, it was not so much the atomic bombings. It was the fear of Russia coming into Japan. A very important fact that most Americans are oblivious to.
Why did they drop the bomb on Nagasaki on August 9th, 1945? They'd already dropped a little boy on Hiroshima on August 5th.
It was August 6th and August 9th, our time.
So they'd already dropped their bomb. They'd tested a little boy on Hiroshima. Why did they then drop their fat man plutonium bomb on Nagasaki, knowing that they'd already made their point, tested their bomb?
Good question. I've been to both of the cities, by the way. Hiroshima is a flat city. So the first bombing, August 6th on Hiroshima, was a uranium bomb. They called it Little Boy. And also the estimates of how many people died immediately, that still fluctuates. My reading from the Japanese sources is that something like 150,000, 200,000 people died immediately just from the Hiroshima, the small bomb, the Little Boy bomb. 3 days later, we decided to drop the second bomb on Nagasaki. Now, Nagasaki, unlike Hiroshima, Nagasaki is a hilly city, and the bomb that was dropped on Nagasaki was a plutonium bomb. It's very clear these were experimental bombs. As we know, the Japanese were ready to surrender. Oppenheimer and Leslie Groves said, nope, full speed ahead. We've got to use these damn things. And so the first bomb on a flat city using a uranium bomb. The second one, more experimental, was a plutonium bomb in a ring city. The idea was to see how these neutrons were going to bounce off the hills and irradiate the people of Nagasaki. So the second bomb was more of an experimental bomb.
How is that known?
This is all out there. This is when you start looking at the literature, we now know that this is all common knowledge now, that the second bomb was intended to see how these neutrons were going to bounce off the hills using the plutonium bomb, which was a little bit bigger than the first bomb.
And who was saying this? Who was saying, hey, you know, like the neutrons are going to bounce off? Who can you pin that?
All the reports came out afterwards, even government reports. There's a guy named William Gladstone in 1957 wrote a big book about nuclear weapons. He's got a whole chapter about Nagasaki, the Nagasaki bomb. G-L-A-S-S Stone, Gladstone, and other sources, but it's not hidden knowledge.
Is this still controversial today? Like, I have a recollection, my father, who was a New York City banker, telling us a story. This must have been in the early 1970s, when he had read about this new information that Americans knew that the Japanese were trying to surrender and that they had been conveying messages through the Russians. The Russians hadn't yet entered the war, and so the Russians weren't conveying that information to the Americans. But the Americans already knew because they'd cracked the Japanese codes, and the Americans were just really anxious to test out the bomb on a live population. And my father went in and he said, I want some information about Hiroshima, having read this. And they said, well, there's so much information about Hiroshima. What do you want to know? And my father recounted this story, and the person called over a security guard and had him escorted out of the library.
Hmm. Wow.
I mean, you know, did this happen? I recall this story of my father's, but this was an incredibly radical idea, a subversive idea to be putting forward. I mean, is this still a controversial idea that the Americans dropped the bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki knowing that they were needless? They didn't need to drop them, and they were actually being told by their most senior military officers, don't do it, but they wanted to do it because they realized this would be their last chance to test them out on a live population. Is this controversial today?
Not so much today. It's important to note, though, that at the time Truman decided to drop the bomb on Hiroshima, something like 80% of the American people were in favor of that, still feeling stung by Pearl Harbor. And in fact, as you well know, after the war, you know, the mantra, you know, remember the Japs, they used to call them the Japs, you know, really derogatory term for the Japanese. Remember Pearl Harbor, remember Pearl Harbor. So I think to go back to that moment in history is really important, with 80% of the public saying, yeah, go ahead and nuke them. Of course, in today's world, you know, that seems outrageous. But back in the day, it's important to consider that. The other thing is, the Japanese surrendered, as I mentioned, 5 days after Nagasaki on August 14th, 1945. And here's what they said. They said that they attributed their capitulation to the atomic bombing, which they referred to. This is the quote. They referred to it as the miracle weapon. And they said it was less embarrassing to have been defeated by the miracle weapon than by the USSR. This is the Japanese official statement. So they knew it was really the Russians that caused them to capitulate, not so much the atomic bombings in addition to the Russians surrendering. So that's kind of the history that we never quite got clear. We didn't need to use the atomic bomb in World War II to end the war. So we've lived in a state of terror for 78 years. The interesting thing, David, as you and I have been following these issues for decades, is that, you know, amazingly, an atomic bomb has not been used since Nagasaki 78 years ago. That's pretty amazing. I don't think we could have predicted that in the late 40s and 50s, especially, you know, during the Cuban Missile Crisis in 62. We came very close to using nuclear weapons. Daniel Ellsberg, I'll never forget, about 30 years ago, Ellsberg wrote a very interesting article. He claimed that there were about 30 instances where we came close to using nuclear weapons. It wasn't just the Cuban Missile Crisis. There were other incidents where we came very close. So we've been living in a state of terror since Oppenheimer and Groves decided to drop that bomb, and Truman decided to drop that bomb on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And shame on us for doing that.
Glenn Alkaway, thank you so much for joining me on the Green Planet Monitor.
Okay. Thank you for doing the interview, David. I really appreciate it.
Glenn Alkaway is an associate professor of anthropology at John Jay College of Criminal Justice at City University of New York. Since serving as a Peace Corps volunteer in the Marshall Islands, Alkaway has devoted his life to uncovering the uncomfortable truths about the U.S. bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki and its nuclear weapons testing program in the Marshalls. I'll post our complete conversation at greenplanetmonitor.net. Before listening to Glenn, click on that subscription box and pull out your credit card. You'll be helping to make this weekly news package happen. Thank you. It's a sobering truth that few know. Having dropped those two bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki 80 years ago, America would probably not have become the most powerful nation in the world had it not been for a string of atolls in the Central Pacific and the hospitable islanders who let it test its burgeoning nuclear arsenal there. They didn't have much choice. America tested its first bomb, Trinity, in Alamogordo, New Mexico. It dropped its second and third bombs on Japan. A year later, in July 1946, the U.S. set off Able and Baker at Bikini Atoll. 21 more would follow, including the Leviathan Bravo blast on March 1, 1954. 44 bombs were tested at Eniwetok Atoll in the Northern Marshalls. Here's a story I produced back in 2007. Nothing much has changed.
Ladies and gentlemen, the captain has indicated we're on a final approach to Demantura. We'd like to hear the cabin for landing.
5 hours out of Honolulu, the Marshall Islands suddenly appear in the middle of the Pacific, a turquoise atoll surrounded by a necklace of white and green. Beneath towering blue-gray clouds, mushroom clouds come easily to mind. This, after all, is where the U.S. tested its nuclear bombs, 67 in total between 1946 and 1958. That's equivalent to a Hiroshima-sized blast each week for a dozen years. Twenty-three of these bombs were detonated at Bikini, a name carved in Cold War memory. 167 people were living on Bikini when testing began. The U.S. Navy asked if they'd leave. Yes, said their leader, and their exodus began. From atoll to atoll, the Bikinians were moved in a series of bungled relocations. Many of them ended up here, on tiny Edget Island, part of the capital atoll of Majuro. I've come to Edget with Bikini advocate Jack Niedenthal. We're walking down a path of crunchy coral.
Well, we're walking over towards the graveyard now, and it's in their culture to be buried away from your home island. It's not good. Even in their original national anthem, the last line of the anthem was, "This is where I want to die and be buried." When they're speaking about their land. So here you have a graveyard filled with Bikinians that have died over the past 25, 30 years, and they're all buried away from their homeland, from their ancestral lands.
Back on Majuro's main island, Jack's office sits beside a mural that reads, "One nuclear bomb can ruin your whole day." Niedenthal describes how the bombing at Bikini began.
Of course, the first bomb was in Alamogordo, New Mexico, and the second two were in Japan, and they needed some place for the fourth and fifth test. They wanted some place that was really far away from everything. And they looked around, and there in the Marshall Islands, way off in the corner, was Bikini Atoll. It was perfect.
The biggest blast at Bikini was a hydrogen bomb codenamed Bravo. The March 1st, 1954 Bravo shot rocketed vaporized coral and dust 100,000 feet into the sky.
Well, I remember the big loud sound and the lightning and something just arise from the west. It just stretched up and then go down, went down again.
Lamayo Abon was 14 years old at the time and living on Little Rongelap Atoll, 100 miles away from Bikini. Now, she's 64, and we're sitting in the lobby of the crowded Tide Table restaurant. She describes what it was like being rained on by fallout.
Something like powder fell on our hair, on our skin, even our foot. But we went and it. Because we didn't know what was going on.
50 years after Bravo, Lamayo is party to a class action suit before the U.S.-funded Marshall Islands Nuclear Claims Tribunal. The lawsuit claims that the U.S. encouraged the people of Rongelap to return home shortly after Bravo, when Rongelap was still contaminated.
This group of people provides a most valuable source of data.
In an upstairs office across the street from the Tide table, Bill Graham acts as public defender for the tribunal. He's reading a 1958 document on his computer screen.
We need to find out how radiation moves from the soil through the food chain and into human beings. Wow, it reeks of, feels like maybe there was some experimentation going on here. The Marshallese were used to provide that knowledge, and they are entitled to compensation for the risks and the damages that they suffered.
Local officials expect the Nuclear Claims Tribunal will award the people of Rongelap over $500 million for their troubles, but there's a catch. There's no cash left to pay them. The U.S. only gave the tribunal $50 million to settle all Marshallese nuclear claims, nowhere near enough to pay the Ground Zero atolls of Bikini and Eniwetok. The Marshall Islands government is asking Washington for an additional $2 billion to cover outstanding claims and the upcoming Rongelap Award, but the Bush administration is recommending that no more funds be provided. Some islands may never be suitable for communities or food gathering and should remain off limits, the Bush administration says. Public defender Bill Graham has heard it all before. He slumps in his chair, waves his arms in the air, and mimics the Bush administration line.
Settlement agreement said, here's a $150 million fund. It will last forever. 12% plus return was anticipated by this settlement agreement. You give so much to Bikini, so much to Eniwetok, so much to Rongelap, so much to Utrecht for a 15-year period. You give so much for a health program. You give so much to the Nuclear Claims Tribunal. At the end of the run, you still have $150 million producing $18 million. What's the problem? We've dealt with this.
The problem is that people are still sick.
Ears are missing, the fingers are developed. They have an old fussy. It looks like more of a mongoloid baby. They go as maybe 2 months, then they die.
Many of them come here to this crowded clinic. Filipino Dr. Gail Lavinia sees babies with bizarre problems whose parents weren't alive during the nuclear testing period.
It is running 2 generations, and they're young, late 20s. So I expect that it will go along the line. And I could not attribute it to anything else, but probably radiation.
Dr. Azua, 2241, please. Dr. Azua, 2241, thank you.
Nuclear radiation penetrates skin, damaging tissues beneath. Here at Majuro Hospital, there are signs of even deeper damage. Exiled from their poisoned atolls, where food can no longer be grown, Marshall Islanders now eat U.S.-imported junk food. Diabetes has become rampant. Dr. Kamal Gunawardhan, a Sri Lankan surgeon, amputates limbs day after day.
Look at it. We started this operating room register on the 8th. Today is 10th. So far, we have had 1 bologna amputation yesterday, then one disarticulation of the hip today, and another bologna amputation today.
Diabetes related.
Every amputation I have done here is diabetes related. A lot of lifestyle diseases too, hypertension, cardiac problems.
Up a set of wooden stairs here on the edge of downtown Majuro at a local drop-in center for youth at risk, I come across 17-year-old Anna sitting by herself in a room. Anna is curled around a ukulele. In this nation of nuclear refugees, Anna's generation is a long way from home. Erlane Milne is their counselor. A group gathers round us as she runs through a list of youth problems.
Cigarette, smoking, alcohol. Ilo family ka ilo community?
Family.
within the families also and within the communities.
You're correct.
Teen pregnancy also.
It's not easy being young in the Marshalls, but the kids at Youth to Youth and Health are tackling their problems through theater and radio. Across the street from Youth to Youth and Health, down this coral-strewn pathway to the edge of Majuro Lagoon, Ben Chutaro is tackling health problems too.
Every little bit counts, you know.
Ben helped found Youth to Youth and Health, and now he's engaged in several other healthy community projects.
I like that saying, says, think globally but act locally.
Ben is typical of young Marshallese entrepreneurs. He's not angry at the U.S. for all the damage it's caused. He'd rather the Marshalls move forward.
So, where are we going right now?
We're going to Jenrick Village. And of course, traffic has just gotten crazy here. Everyone wants a car, even though this island is not that long.
Finally, we arrive at our destination. I'm standing on top of a pile of garbage.
Yep.
Flip-flops, plastic containers, garbage.
It's a symptom of overcrowding. We import basically a lot of things from the U.S., and basically what I think is we should, you know, after we use these products, I think we should send them back and recycle them. You know, send them back to the U.S.
Yeah. The revenue that's raised through recycling could be used to buy sporting equipment, eventually maybe build a basketball court, and address the social problems. Like we mentioned, there's high alcoholism, particularly at the youth level, to try to address some of those problems at the root, you know, at the root level. Yeah. So.
Les Jones, nice to meet you.
Les is our deputy commander.
If healing old wounds were all Marshall Islanders faced, their task would be relatively simple. It's not. The U.S. military is still here.
The name is U.S. Army Kwajalein Atoll. Ronald Reagan Ballistic Missile Defense Test Site at Kwajalein Atoll. I'm not kidding.
Les Jones is Deputy Garrison Commander at Kwajalein Atoll Military Base in the Central Marshalls. For years, Kwajalein Atoll has acted as a bullseye for missiles fired from the U.S. Today, high-tech facilities at Kwajalein are considered vital as the Pentagon prepares to defend America against a possible North Korean missile attack.
This mission that's coming up is going to be what they call a zero flyby of the interceptor with a incoming reentry vehicle.
And now what does that mean?
What does that mean?
Will a missile be fired from Vandenberg?
No, it will not be. The missile is actually coming out of Kodiak, Alaska, and a ground-based interceptor is what it's called, will be fired out of Mech Island.
So, like, if I were sitting on the wharf at Ebi, you know, on a deck chair, drinking lots of coffee, keeping myself awake for a long period of time, what would I see?
If anything, you will see a column of smoke. Bright light going up, column of smoke behind it, and that's all.
As it turned out, there was nothing to be seen. The interceptor rocket failed to fire from Mech Island, and the test was scrubbed. Instead, I took this boat from Kwajalein to tiny, overcrowded Ebi Island. The military base's 1,200 Marshallese workers live here. So do 10,000 other islanders, many of them moved from homes in the Pentagon's missile range. Julian Riklon is one of these.
Ebi is an island of houses. It's a bunch of plywoods and, you know, concrete buildings. And here we're coming to the grave sites.
Ebi is so crowded, there's no room for the living, much less the dead. So what do we have here?
This is one of the three grave sites on Ebi. There was a time when an epidemic broke out, some kind of flu, and a lot of kids died. Since there's not enough space, they have to dug up the children's grave and bury the older folks.
So the old remains and the new remains are all mixed together?
They're all mixed together, and people don't know where their relatives' graves are now because it's been replaced by new ones.
Unfair treatment and what have you being heaped upon FAS citizens being deported from America, and he said DUI or driving under the influence. And
everyone in the Marshall Islands knows the voice of Fred Pedro, the most outspoken public critic of the U.S. presence on Kwajalein. Fred Pedro is a veteran of three successive Marshall Islands governments and now prefers to speak his mind over the airwaves. Fred Pedro's radio station, he's actually a co-owner, is on the top floor of this abandoned hotel here on the edge of downtown Majuro.
Hello.
Hello.
I'm looking for Fred Pedro.
Who?
Fred Pedro, radio.
He's at a number. 24. But do you want to buy
ticket? I'm sorry?
Ticket.
I go upstairs. Como tata?
Pimps and hookers loiter in the hallway. The stench of urine fills the air. I find Fred Pedro in room 24. He describes how Ibai Islanders are treated at the U.S. base.
Everyone is checked to see whether, you know, how many candy bars they got in their bag and how many cans of beer that they... I mean, how can a candy bar and a six-pack of beer affect the U.S. national security? And yet Marshallese are fighting alongside American soldiers in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Fred Pedro thinks the Marshall Islands have been betrayed. They've given the U.S. so much, he says, and have received nothing but trouble in return.
You know, here's the United States going around the world shouting, you know, at the top of its lung, I am the good guy. I am the champion of democracy, the defender of human rights and the upholder of the downtrodden and the oppressed. The right of wrongs between nations. They better right some of the wrongs that they've done here.
The Marshall Islands government can ask for $2 billion to cover nuclear claims and improve its healthcare system. Washington can say no. There are only 60,000 people living out there, Henry Kissinger reportedly said years ago. Who gives a damn? Kissinger's sentiment sums up how many Marshallese view past relations with the U.S. and their own future. They know they only have themselves to rely on, lost, as it were, in the middle of the Pacific. Not much has changed since this doc was produced. Bikini is still contaminated and has not been resettled. Radiation monitoring continues. Adjudicated claims have yet to be paid. Trust funds have been squandered. A third compact of free association between the U.S. and the Marshallese Republic is on track to be approved this fall. The Marshalls faithfully vote the way Washington tells them to at the U.N. Ibai is still packed, and the U.S. continues to fire missiles at Kwajalein Atoll from California and Alaska. The Marshallese people are as friendly as ever. Diabetes and heart disease kill more of them than nuclear-related cancers. Read more about this sorry state of affairs at greenplanetmonitor.net. That's it for today's GPM, a listener-supported podcast coming to you from Earth Chronicle Productions in the Netherlands. Listen, read, and watch more Earth stories at greenplanetmonitor.net. Find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube, and our home base, Blueberry. We're also on Facebook and Twitter, and the Harbinger Media Network. Wherever or however you're listening, reading, or watching, please help us make the GPM happen. Subscribe and or donate at greenplanetmonitor.net. By the way, the guy behind this guitar is Dan Weisenberger. Thanks for your brilliant instrumental themes, Dan. I'm David Kattenberg. Over and out. For now.